Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. One of Milwaukee's nicknames is the City of Steeples. It has the fourth highest count of houses of worship relative to its population in the country. That's according to a recent study completed for the Milwaukee Historic Preservation Commission.
The Catholic Archdiocese of Milwaukee has the largest footprint of any religion in the Milwaukee area. It's on the verge of more multi-parish consolidations, as well as some potential closures and property sales.
Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Sophie Carson has been reporting about the challenges facing Catholic churches with empty pews and vacant buildings, and she joins us now. Sophie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been reporting on the diocese and the physical spaces of its buildings. And can you first give us an idea of how prevalent Catholics are in the Milwaukee area?
Yeah, Milwaukee is historically a Catholic stronghold, as well as several other cities across the Midwest, like Chicago and Pittsburgh. But Milwaukee, there's a survey that says about 25% of Wisconsinites consider themselves Catholic. In Milwaukee in the 60s, about 38% of people were affiliated with a parish. Today in the Milwaukee area, that's about 22%. But, you know, that legacy of all those people who were affiliated with a parish, churchgoers, that really has made an impact, like you say, in the physical spaces that now kind of dot the landscape.
And it sounds as if the priests especially are very concerned about all of the buildings, all of the infrastructure that needs to be kept up. How are the churches and the parishes looking at their infrastructure?
They're doing a lot of realizing in recent years, as well as in the future here, they're going to be realizing for the people that are here, there's simply too many buildings in many places across the archdiocese. So what they're doing is saying, we're short on resources, we're short on funds, we're short on people. How can we streamline things? What can we get rid of? What don't we need anymore? Is this school empty? Could we rent it out? Could we sell the property? So lots of places are doing little things to sort of streamline. But in general, the broader focus that I was writing about was this idea of merging. Mm-hmm. One or two or three churches will merge into one parish. Parish is just an administrative entity. So they might keep all the buildings open, or they might, you know, down the line say, okay, we'll keep two of the three open and sell the third one. So those are some of the things that they're doing.
And you've learned from clergy leaders about this vision for, I think they called it regional groupings of churches. So they have a senior pastor and they have associates. How would that structure look like in these mergers?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are some examples of this already generally in like some rural areas of the far edges of southeastern Wisconsin. So it would be like a more experienced priest with two, say, younger priests, and they travel around between several churches in an area. So this is already kind of happening in some of these, say, clusters or collaborations in rural areas. But the archdiocese officials I spoke to said they kind of see this as the next step, like down the line, this is the model they think will be most effective.
You write about that historically churches served as these social meeting places, not only, you know, places of worship, but places for voting, for food pantries, for outreach centers, for support groups. Could those types of spaces be in jeopardy as we see the decline in the number of churchgoers?
That's definitely a concern for people. There's a researcher, he's not Catholic, he's at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And he has this idea that, you know, when a church closes, the services it provides to people are gone for good. Mm. And I think that in some cases is true. There's an example here in Wauwatosa, where a Catholic church right on the edge of the downtown village area is, the land has been sold and the land is going to be redeveloped into luxury apartments. There was a food pantry at that church. That food pantry is actually moving to a different church, but it's this idea that, you know, in some places if churches aren't prepared and they close, those resources, those services might not be elsewhere. There's also something to be said about the community aspects of churches in the mid-20th century, you know, how they were sort of the center of social lives in these burgeoning suburbs. And that is just not necessarily how most of American life is structured today.
You mentioned the book Gone for Good and Reverend Mark Elsden. We talked with him back a few months ago about church downsizing and about property transitions. And I want to just listen here. Here he is talking about the use of church buildings.
The question of how to make best use of church real estate, buildings, and land is really a question for any church, not just ones that are struggling or ones that are going to close or ones that are shrinking, but all of them, even ones that are thriving, because there's so many ways that we can use the kind of the assets, the property and the land and the buildings for good in our communities.
So if parishes do put blinders on, Sophie, and don't deal with the problems and look at these buildings in new ways, what might happen?
I had people tell me that these churches could close, these communities could cease to exist, you know, numbers wise. Eventually, it'd get to a point where it just doesn't make sense for these churches to remain open. There's not any money in it. There's no people left. You know, this is something, a very real possibility that several parishes are kind of staring down and considering seeing in their future unless they change. And they believe that the change that could help them is, you know, collaborating, pooling resources, consolidating in the ways that they can to spend less money on buildings, spend less money on maintaining roofs and hot water heaters and all this kind of thing, and more money on reaching out into the community, welcoming new people. That's easier said than done, though, I suppose.
And religion being part of your beat, I wonder, Sophie, what are you watching for as the future unfolds for Catholics in Milwaukee?
You know, I think the biggest story in general is just right now on the religion beat is the rise of nuns, N-O-N-E-S's. These are people who claim no religious affiliation. They're not, say, atheists, but they're people who just are disconnected from their churches or, you know, feel no religious affiliation. And this is definitely a growing population, has been for a while. I think as this population rises, you know, we're having more and more impacts from that. There are more and more effects, you know, both with properties, what happens to these properties, as well as social and cultural trends and changes. So I think that's definitely the biggest thing.
Sophie, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much, Kate.
Sophie Carson covers religion, immigration, and breaking news for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Now to Sarah Larson, executive director and founder of the nonprofit Awake. It's a Milwaukee-based survivor support and advocacy organization that focuses on clergy sex abuse. The organization has a new program bringing together non-offending priests and abuse survivors for transformative conversations. Sarah, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You recently launched these Bridge Dialogues. How does it work and what are your initial takeaways?
This is a really exciting program for us that we've been thinking about really for a long time. And I first want to say that the inspiration for this really came from survivors in our community who were sharing what they most needed and wanted. And we actually put together a survey, and the survivors that responded, among all the various options we were considering offering, the most popular choice was opportunities to connect with and dialogue with priests. And so we were really surprised by this, but I think it speaks to the need that some, although certainly not all, abuse survivors feel for a sense of healing and reconciliation with the priesthood, regardless of whether they want to remain Catholic. We've seen that a lot of healing can come in this kind of open conversation. So what we are doing is we're inspired by the principles of restorative justice and creating these conversations that are designed to bridge that gap between priests and those who have been harmed by Catholic leaders. And so we're putting together facilitated conversation in a confidential setting. We do this on Zoom because we are serving people from throughout the United States. Each dialogue brings together three Catholic priests and three people who have experienced sexual abuse by a Catholic leader, along with two facilitators from Awake staff. We as facilitators guide the group through a really simple process of honest sharing and respectful listening, giving all participants an opportunity to speak from their hearts about the ways they have been impacted and what they hope for in the church moving forward. What we've seen in creating this space is so many beautiful things come from bringing people together, presuming goodwill of one another, and then honestly listening and seeking understanding. So we have seen survivors who have attended, and you know, one woman just said recently that she never thought she would be in a conversation like this with a priest. Her abuse happened over 40 years ago when she was a child, and she's experiencing healing that she has not encountered in her life up to this point. We're also hearing from the priests that have participated that it's really refreshing for them to be able to be in a space where they can address this issue openly and honestly, and really listen in an open and heartfelt way to survivors and learn from their stories. There are so many survivors that want to have something good come out of the terrible things that have happened to them. And they, many people are expressing that it's really meaningful to them both to, you know, receive, say, words of apology and words of compassion from a priest today, but also to know that they are making a difference in helping today's priests better serve survivors, be more aware of the dynamics of abuse, and just generally be better priests. And so there, many of them are very excited about the opportunity to use their experiences for something good.
Hmm. I would imagine, though, these conversations can be so emotional, so triggering for survivors. How do you, as the facilitator, keep these conversations, you know, respectful and honest and open and okay for all involved?
No, it's a really good question. And you're right. These are very, very sensitive conversations, and they can be very emotional and certainly triggering. A lot of what makes this possible is all of the work we do in accompanying survivors leading up to a bridge dialogue. So many of the survivors who are participating, we've been accompanying for many years. They meet with us regularly in our survivor circles. They come on a summer retreat with us. So they have built a lot of trust and a feeling of safety in the spaces that Awake creates. And so they come into this with a trust in, you know, they have personal relationships with the facilitators. So they're coming in knowing that they can trust us to be trauma-informed and to be compassionate and to listen to what they need. Another really important factor is that we try to give as much information as possible in advance so that people, both the survivors and the priests, can feel prepared. And that's just such an important trauma-informed principle anyway. We make very clear exactly what's going to happen in the dialogue. These are the questions you will be asked. Here's the order that we will go in. Here are the people who will be attending, so that people can do a lot of the preparation in their own minds and hearts before coming, so that things won't take them by surprise. Now, all that said, it's still a difficult conversation. One of the things that we've built in is that we take time to, you know, invite people to take care of themselves, to take a deep breath, to step away if they need to. And after the dialogue itself ends, we actually split the priests and the survivors into two groups, into two breakout rooms, and we take some time to decompress and debrief together. And so the survivors have a space at the end to discuss with one another and one of the facilitators, and also do a little bit of grounding and a little processing together. And then we continue to walk with them in the weeks and months ahead. And so this is not a one-off experience, but it is part of their ongoing accompaniment in this community.
Sarah, can you speak to the confidential aspect of these dialogues, of these conversations?
Absolutely. There are many abuse survivors who are willing to share their stories and perhaps feel called to share their stories in public forums. And so AWAKE is always trying to create spaces for them to do that. And we have speaking opportunities and ways to tell their stories publicly on our website. But there are also many survivors who don't want that right now and may never want to be more public about these experiences in their life. And so it's very important for them to be able to engage in these dialogues in a way that their name is not made public. We have clear guidelines that express the confidentiality of the space. And so they are able to enter in the conversation knowing their identity will not be disclosed. I will also say that that feels important for the priests as well. You know, many of the priests that are engaging in these dialogues might not feel comfortable speaking publicly about these issues. They might not know if they have the right things to say, and they might feel like they're always being evaluated for whether they're saying or doing the right things. And in this space, we're really trying to encourage them to be their authentic human selves, to know they're not being recorded, their words are not being written down. They're really showing up just as a human being meeting other human beings for a conversation.
And this is newly launched, the Bridge Dialogues. How will you evaluate this as it moves forward, this type of programming? And what is that goal of yours in the future on these Bridge Dialogues?
So we actually started piloting these programs, the Bridge Dialogues, last year. So we've actually had four dialogues leading up to this more public launch because we knew this was such a sensitive area and honestly, a new type of work that really hasn't been done before in terms of sexual abuse by Catholic leaders. And so we really wanted to take time with priests and survivors we already knew well to develop this program. So a lot of the evaluation of and refining of the program has happened during those pilot dialogues, but every time we get together for a new dialogue, we learn a little bit more and tweak a few new things. And we always ask for feedback from all the participants afterwards to have them tell us what we could have done better. And we're also looking at moving forward, trying to figure out how we can have this kind of offering have even more impact and reach even more people, because these are really, really powerful, healing conversations. And we would like more people to have access to them. So in the new year, we'll be looking at how else can we be bridge builders and how else can we work for healing in the church and among priests and survivors in ways that maybe haven't been done before.
Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sarah Larson is Executive Director of AWAKE. It's a Milwaukee community of abuse survivors and concerned Catholics responding to sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. And earlier, we talked with Sophie Carson of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about her recent reporting on challenges facing the Archdiocese of Milwaukee.